Instead, they recognize a pattern and know, almost reflexively, what the most powerful moves and counter-moves would likely be. No longer do they have to apply their short-term memory and analytical skills to imagine what would happen if they made this move and their opponent made that move, and so on, trying to recall the position of every piece on the board. Instead, they have a good general idea of what is going on in a given position, in terms of lines of force or whatever imaging technique they use, and they use their logical abilities to work with their mental representations rather than the individual pieces on the board. With enough solitary practice, the mental representations become so useful and powerful in playing the game that the major thing separating two players is not their intelligence, their visuospatial abilities, or even their memory or processing speed, but rather the quality and quantity of their mental representations and how effectively they use them. Because these mental representations are developed specifically for the purpose of analyzing chess positions and coming up with the best moves, remember, they are usually developed through thousands of hours of studying the games of grandmasters. They're far more effective for playing chess than simply using one's memory and logic and analyzing the collection of pieces on the board as individually interacting items. Thus, by the time one becomes a grandmaster, or even an accomplished 12-year-old tournament player, the abilities measured by IQ tests are far less important than the mental representations one has developed through practice. This explains, I believe, why we see no relationship between IQ and chess ability when we look at accomplished players. Of course, the abilities measured by IQ tests do seem to play a role early on, and it seems that children with higher IQs will play chess more capably in the beginning. But what Bilalic and his colleagues found was that among the children who played in chess tournaments, that is, the chess players who were devoted enough to the game to take it to a level beyond playing in their school chess club, there was a tendency for the ones with lower IQs to have engaged in more practice. We don't know why, but we can speculate. All of these elite players were committed to chess, and in the beginning, the ones with higher IQs had a somewhat easier time developing their ability. The others, in an effort to keep up, practiced more. And having developed the habit of practicing more, they actually went on to become better players than the ones with higher IQs, who initially didn't feel the same pressure to keep up. And here we find our major takeaway message. In the long run, it is the ones who practice more who prevail, not the ones who had some initial advantage in intelligence or some other talent. The real role of innate characteristics. The results from the chess study provide a crucial insight into the interplay between talent and practice in the development of various skills. While people with certain innate characteristics, IQ in the case of the chess study, may have an advantage when first learning a skill, that advantage gets smaller over time, and eventually the amount and the quality of practice take on a much larger role in determining how skilled a person becomes. Researchers have seen evidence of this pattern in many different fields. In music, as in chess, there is an early correlation between IQ and performance. For example, a study of 91 fifth-grade students who were given piano instruction for 6 months found that, on average, the students with higher IQs performed better at the end of those 6 months than those with lower IQs. However, the measured correlation between IQ and music performance gets smaller as the years of music study increase, and tests have found no relationship between IQ and music performance among music majors in college or among professional musicians. In a study on expertise in oral surgery, the performance of dental students was found to be related to their performance on tests of visuospatial ability, and the students who scored higher on those tests also performed better on surgical simulations done on the model of a jaw. However, when the same test was done on dental residents and dental surgeons, no such correlation was found. Thus, the initial influence of visuospatial ability on surgical performance disappears over time as the dental students practice their skills. And by the time they have become residents, the differences in talent, in this case visuospatial ability, no longer have a visible effect. Among the people studying to be London taxi drivers that we discussed in Chapter 2, there was no difference in IQ between the ones who finished the course and became certified drivers and those who dropped out. IQ made no difference in how well the drivers could learn to find their way around London. The average IQ of scientists is certainly higher than the average IQ of the general population. But among scientists, there is no correlation between IQ and scientific productivity. Indeed, a number of Nobel Prize-winning scientists have had IQs that would not even qualify them for Mensa, an organization whose members must have a measured IQ of at least 132, a number that puts you in the upper 2 percentile of the population. Richard Feynman, one of the most brilliant physicists of the 20th century, had an IQ of 126. James Watson, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, had an IQ of 124. And William Shockley, who received the Nobel Prize in Physics for his role in the invention of the transistor, had an IQ of 125. Although the abilities measured by IQ tests clearly help performance in the science classroom, and students with higher IQs generally performed better in science classes than those with lower IQs, again, consistent with Binet's efforts to measure school learning, among those who have become professional scientists, a higher IQ doesn't seem to offer an advantage. A number of researchers have suggested that there are, in general, minimum requirements for performing capably in various areas. For instance, it has been suggested that scientists in at least some fields need an IQ score of around 110 to 120 to be successful, but that a higher score doesn't confer any additional benefit. However, it is not clear whether that IQ score of 110 is necessary to actually perform the duties of a scientist or simply to get to the point where you can be hired as a scientist. In many scientific fields, you need to hold a PhD to be able to get research grants and conduct research, and getting a PhD requires 4 to 6 years of successful postgraduate academic performance with a high level of writing skills and a large vocabulary, which are essentially attributes measured by verbal intelligence tests. Furthermore, most science PhD programs demand mathematical and logical thinking, which are measured by other components of intelligence tests. When college graduates apply to graduate school, they have to take such tests as the Graduate Record Examination, GRE, which measures these abilities, and only the high-scoring students are accepted into science graduate programs. Thus, from this perspective, it is not surprising that scientists generally have IQ scores of 110 to 120 or above. Without the ability to achieve such scores, it is unlikely they would have ever had the chance to become scientists in the first place. One could also speculate that there are certain minimum talent requirements for such things as playing sports or painting, so that people who fall below those requirements would find it difficult or impossible to become highly skilled in those areas. But outside of some very basic physical traits, such as height and body size in sports, we have no solid evidence that such minimum requirements exist. We do know, and this is important, that among those people who have practiced enough and have reached a certain level of skill in their chosen field, there is no evidence that any genetically determined abilities play a role in deciding who will be among the best. Once you get to the top, it isn't natural talent that makes the difference, at least not talent in the way it is usually understood as an innate ability to excel at a particular activity. I believe this explains why it is so difficult to predict who will rise to the top of any given field. If some sort of innate ability were playing a role in deciding who eventually becomes the best in a particular area, it would be much easier to spot those future champions early in their careers. If, for instance, the best professional football players were the ones who were born with some sort of gift for football, then that gift should certainly be apparent by the time they're in college, at which point they have generally been playing football for half a dozen years or more. But in reality, no one has figured out how to look at college football players and figure out which will be the best and which will be duds. In 2007, quarterback Jamarcus Russell of Louisiana State University was chosen first overall in the NFL draft. He was a complete bust and was out of football within 3 years. By contrast, Tom Brady was picked in the sixth round of the 2000 draft, after 198 other players, and he developed into one of the best quarterbacks ever. A 2012 study of tennis players looked at the success and rankings of junior tennis players, that is, younger players who were working and competing to become professionals, and compared that with their success after turning pro. There was no relationship. If differences in innate talent were playing a role in determining the best professional tennis players, you'd think those differences would have been noticeable during their junior tennis years as well, but they were not. The bottom line is that no one has ever managed to figure out how to identify people with innate talent. No one has ever found a gene variant that predicts superior performance in one area or another, and no one has ever come up with a way to, say, test young children and identify which among them will become the best athletes, or the best mathematicians, or the best doctors, or the best musicians. There is a simple reason for this. If there are indeed genetic differences that play a role in influencing how well someone performs beyond the initial stages when someone is just learning a skill, they aren't likely to be something that affects the relevant skills directly. A music gene, or a chess gene, or a math gene. No, I suspect that such genetic differences, if they exist, are most likely to manifest themselves through the necessary practice and efforts that go into developing a skill. Perhaps, for example, some children are born with a suite of genes that cause them to get more pleasure from drawing or from making music. Then those children will be more likely to draw or to make music than other children. If they're put in art classes or music classes, they're likely to spend more time practicing because it is more fun for them. They carry their sketch pads or guitars with them wherever they go. And over time, these children will become better artists or better musicians than their peers. Not because they are innately more talented in the sense that they have some genes for musical or artistic ability, but because something, perhaps genetic, pushed them to practice and thus developed their skills to a greater degree than their peers. Research on the development of vocabulary in very young children has shown that such factors as the child's temperament and ability to pay attention to a parent influence the size of vocabulary the child will build. Most of a young child's vocabulary development comes through interaction with a parent or other caregiver. And studies have shown that children with a temperament that encourages social interaction end up developing better language skills. Similarly, and more in line with the sorts of factors that may play a role in acquiring skills with practice, 9-month-old infants who paid more attention to a parent as that parent was reading a book and pointing to the pictures in the book grew up to have a much better vocabulary at 5 years of age than infants who paid less attention. It is possible to imagine a number of genetically based differences of this sort. Some people might, for instance, be naturally able to focus more intently and for longer periods of time than others. Since deliberate practice depends on being able to focus in this way, these people might be naturally able to practice more effectively than others and thus benefit more from their practice. One could even imagine differences in how the brain responds to challenges, so that practice would be more effective in some people than in others in building new brain structures and mental capacity. Much of this remains speculative at this point. But since we know that practice is the single most important factor in determining a person's ultimate achievement in a given domain, it makes sense that if genes do play a role, their role would play out through shaping how likely a person is to engage in deliberate practice, or how effective that practice is likely to be. Seeing it in this way puts genetic differences in a completely different light. The dark side of believing in innate talent. In this chapter, I've discussed the roles that practice and innate talent play in the development of expert performers, and I've argued that while innate characteristics may influence performance among those who are just learning a new skill or ability, the degree and the effectiveness of training plays a more significant role in determining who excels among those who have worked to develop a skill. This is because, ultimately, the body's and the brain's natural ability to adapt in the face of challenges outweighs any genetic differences that may in the beginning give some people an advantage. So I believe that it's much more important to understand how and why particular types of practice lead to improvement than it is to go looking for genetic differences between people. But there is, I believe, an even more urgent reason to emphasize the role of practice over that of innate differences, and that is the danger of the self-fulfilling prophecy. When people assume that talent plays a major, even determining role in how accomplished a person can become, that assumption points one toward certain decisions and actions. If you assume that people who are not innately gifted are never going to be good at something, then the children who don't excel at something right away are encouraged to try something else. The clumsy ones are pushed away from sports. The ones who can't carry a tune right away are told they should try something other than music. And the ones who don't immediately get comfortable with numbers are told they are no good at math. And no surprise, the predictions come true. The girl who was told to forget about sports never becomes any good at hitting a tennis ball or kicking a soccer ball. The boy who was told he was tone deaf never learns to play a musical instrument or to sing well. And the children who were told they were no good at math grow up believing it. The prophecy becomes self-fulfilling. On the flip side, of course, the children who get more attention and praise from their teachers and coaches, and more support and encouragement from their parents, do end up developing their abilities to a much greater degree than the ones who were told never to try, thus convincing everyone that their initial appraisals were correct. Again, self-fulfilling. Malcolm Gladwell told a story in his book Outliers, a story that others had told before him, but it was Gladwell's telling that got the most attention. Of how there are many more Canadian professional hockey players born in the months of January through March than born in October through December. Is there something magical about being born in these months that grants extra talent for hockey to babies lucky enough to be born then? No. What happens is that there is a cutoff for playing youth hockey in Canada. You must be a certain age by December 31st of the previous year. And the children born in the first 3 months of the year are the oldest players in each class of players. When children start playing hockey at around age 4 or 5, the advantage that older kids have over younger ones is striking. Kids with an age advantage of close to a year will generally be taller, heavier, and somewhat more coordinated and mentally mature. They may have had one more hockey season to develop their hockey skills. So they are likely to be better at hockey than the younger players in their age group. But those age-related physical differences get smaller and smaller as the hockey players get older, and they have pretty much disappeared by the time the players reach adulthood. So the age-related advantage must have its roots in childhood, when the physical differences still exist. The obvious explanation for the age effect is that it starts with the coaches, who are searching for the most talented players, beginning at the very earliest ages. Coaches can't really tell how old the various child hockey players are. All they can see is who is doing better, and thus, by inference, who appears to be more talented. Many coaches will tend to treat the more talented players with more praise and better instruction, and to give these players more opportunities to play in games. And these players will be viewed as more talented not just by the coach, but also by the other players. Furthermore, these players might be more willing to practice more because they are told that they have the promise of playing at very high levels, even professionally. The results of all this are striking, and not just in hockey. For example, one study found that among 13-year-old soccer players, more than 90% of the ones who were nominated as the best had been born in the first 6 months of the year. The advantage among hockey players does seem to taper off somewhat once the players make it into the major leagues, perhaps because the younger ones who have managed to hang around have learned to work harder at their practicing and thus end up outshining many of the ones who are 6 months older. But there is no doubt that being born in January through March is an advantage to any Canadian boy who wants to play hockey. Now, suppose that the same thing happened with chess. Suppose there was some group of people who selected beginning chess players for some chess program according to what seemed to be their innate talent. They would teach a group of youngsters how to play, and then, after 3 or 6 months had passed, look to see who were the best. We know what would happen. On average, the kids with higher IQs would have an easier time in the beginning, learning the moves, and would be selected for further training and grooming. the others would not be offered a spot in the program. The end result would be a collection of chess players with much higher than average IQs. But we know that in the real world there are many grandmasters who don't score particularly well on IQ tests, so we would have missed the contributions of all those people who could become great chess players. And now, suppose that we're not talking about a chess program, but rather math as it is taught in most schools. No one has done studies with math that match the ones being done with chess, but suppose for a moment that a similar thing is true. That is, that children with a higher spatial intelligence can learn to do basic math more quickly than others. Recent research has shown that children who have had experience playing linear board games with counting steps before they start school will do better in math once they are in school. And there are likely many other ways that certain preschool experiences will help children perform better in math later on. Most teachers, however, are not familiar with this possibility. So when some kids get math more quickly than others, they're generally assumed to be gifted at math, while the others aren't. Then the gifted ones get more encouragement, more training, and so on. And sure enough, after a year or so, they're much better at math than the others, and this advantage propagates through the school years. Since there are a number of careers, like engineering or physics, that require math courses in college, the students who have been judged to have no talent for math find these careers closed to them. But if math works the same way as chess, then we have lost a whole collection of children who might eventually have become quite accomplished in these areas, if only they hadn't been labeled as no good at math in the very beginning. This is the dark side of believing in innate talent. It can beget a tendency to assume that some people have a talent for something and others don't, and that you can tell the difference early on. If you believe that, you encourage and support the talented ones and discourage the rest, creating the self-fulfilling prophecy. It is human nature to want to put effort, time, money, teaching, encouragement, support, where it will do the most good, and also to try to protect kids from disappointment. There is usually nothing nefarious going on here, but the results can be incredibly damaging. The best way to avoid this is to recognize the potential in all of us and work to find ways to develop it. Chapter 9. Where do we go from here? Call it a glimpse. For 1 week, a group of students enrolled in a traditional freshman physics class got a look at what the future of learning physics might look like. It was just one section on electromagnetic waves that was taught toward the end of a two-semester course, but in that one section, the results were almost magical. The students who were taught the material with a method inspired by the principles of deliberate practice learned more than twice as much as those students taught with the traditional approach. By one measure, it was the largest effect ever seen in an educational intervention. This glimpse came courtesy of three researchers associated with the University of British Columbia, Louis Delaurier, Ellen Chaloux, and Carl Wieman. Wieman, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2001, has made a second career out of working to improve undergraduate science education. Using part of his Nobel Prize winnings in 2002, he created the Physics Education Technology Project at the University of Colorado. And later, he established the Carl Wieman Science Education Initiative at the University of British Columbia. In all this, he has been driven by the conviction that there is a better way to teach science than the traditional 50-minute classroom lectures. And this is what he and his two colleagues set out to demonstrate in that bastion of traditional teaching, the freshman physics course. The class at UBC had 850 students in three sections. It was a hardcore physics course aimed at first-year engineering majors, with the physics concepts taught in terms of calculus and the students expected to learn how to solve math-intensive problems. The professors were well-regarded for their teaching skills, with years of experience teaching this particular course, and good scores on their student evaluations. Their method of instruction was relatively standard. 3 50-minute PowerPoint lectures a week, given in a large lecture hall, weekly homework assignments, and tutorial sessions where the students would solve problems under the eye of a teaching assistant. Wyman and his colleagues chose two of the course's sections, each with about 270 students, to serve as their testing ground. For the 12th week of the second semester, one of these sections would continue with instructions as usual, while the other would be presented with a completely different way to learn about electromagnetic waves. The students in the two sections were about as alike as they could possibly be. The average scores on the two midterm tests the students had taken up to that point were identical between the two classes. The average class scores on two standardized tests of physics knowledge given during week 11 were identical. The class attendance rates during weeks 10 and 11 were identical, and the assessed levels of engagement during weeks 10 and 11 were identical for the two classes. In short, up to that point, the two classes had been essentially identical in their classroom behavior and how well they were learning about physics. That was about to change. In the 12th week, as the instructor of one section continued on as usual, the instructor in the second section was replaced with Wyman's two colleagues, Delaurier and Chaloux. Delaurier served as the main instructor, and Chaloux was his assistant. Neither of them had ever been in charge of a class before. Delaurier, a postdoctoral student, had received some training in effective teaching methods, and in particular, the teaching of physics, during his time at the Carl Wyman Science Education Initiative. Chaloux was a physics graduate student who had taken a seminar in physics education. Both had spent some time as teaching assistants, but together they had far less experience in the classroom than the instructor who was continuing to teach the other sections during the week of the trial. What Delaurier and Chaloux did have was a new approach to teaching physics that Wyman and others had developed by applying the principles of deliberate practice. For 1 week, they had the students in their section follow a very different pattern than in the traditional class. Before each class, they were expected to read assigned sections, generally just 3 or 4 pages long, from their physics text, and then complete a short online true-false test about the reading. The idea was to make them familiar with the concepts that would be worked on in class before they ever came to class. To even things out, the students in the traditional class were also asked to do pre-class reading during this 1 week. It was the only change made in how the traditional class was taught during that week. In the deliberate practice class, the goal was not to feed information to the students, but rather to get them to practice thinking like physicists. To do that, Delaurier would first have the students divide up into small groups and then pose a clicker question. That is, a question that the students answered electronically, with the answers sent automatically to the instructor. The questions were chosen to get the students in the class thinking about concepts that typically give first-year physics students difficulty. The students would talk about each question within their small groups, send in their answers, and then Delaurier would display the results and talk about them, answering any questions that the students might have. The discussions got the students thinking about the concepts, drawing connections, and often moving beyond the specific clicker question they'd been asked. Several clicker questions were asked during the course of the class, and sometimes Delaurier might have the student groups discuss a question a second time, after he had offered some thoughts for them to ponder. Sometimes he would offer a mini-lecture if it seemed that the students were having difficulty with a particular idea. Each class also included an active learning task, in which the students in each group considered a question and then individually wrote their answers and submitted them, after which Delaurier would again answer questions and address misconceptions. During the class, Chaloux would walk around among the groups, answering questions, listening to the discussions, and identifying problem areas. The students were much more active participants in this class than in the traditionally taught class. This was demonstrated by the measures of engagement that Wyman's group used. Although there was no difference in engagement between the two groups during weeks 10 and 11, during week 12, the engagement in the class taught by Delaurier was nearly double what it was in the traditional class. But it was more than just engagement. The students in the Delaurier class were getting immediate feedback on their understanding of the various concepts, with both fellow students and the instructors helping clear up any confusion. And both the clicker questions and the active learning tasks were designed to get the students thinking like physicists, to first understand the question in the proper way, then figure out which concepts are applicable, and then reason from those concepts to an answer. The instructor from the traditional class observed Delorier's class before teaching his own and chose to use most of the same clicker questions in his own class, but he did not use them to begin discussions, only to show the class how many students had gotten each answer correct. At the end of week 12, the students in both class sections were given a multiple-choice clicker test to see how well they had learned the material. Delorier and the instructor in the traditional class had worked together to develop a test that they and the instructor of a third section all agreed was a good measure of the learning objectives for that week. The test questions were very standard. Indeed, most of them were clicker questions that had been used for a physics class at another university, sometimes with small modifications. The average score of the students in the traditional section was 41%. The average in Delorier's class was 74%. That is obviously a big difference, but given that random guessing would have produced a score of 23%, when you do the math, it turns out that the students in the traditional class, on average, knew the right answer on only about 24% of the questions, compared with an average of about 66% in the class designed to apply the principles of deliberate practice. That is a huge difference. The students in the deliberate practice class got more than 2.5 times as many right answers as those in the other class. Wyman and his colleagues expressed the difference in another way, using a statistical term known as the effect size. In these terms, the difference between the performances of the two classes was 2.5 standard deviations. For the sake of comparison, other new teaching methods in science and engineering classrooms generally have effect sizes less than 1.0. And the largest effect size observed for an educational intervention before this had been 2.0, which was accomplished with the use of trained personal tutors. Wyman got to 2.5 with a graduate student and a postdoc who had never taught a class before. The promise of deliberate practice. Wyman's achievement is tremendously exciting. It suggests that by modifying traditional teaching approaches to reflect the insights of deliberate practice, we might dramatically improve the effectiveness of teaching in various fields. So where do we start? One place would be with the development of world-class athletes, musicians, and other expert performers. I've always hoped that the work I've done in understanding deliberate practice would prove useful to these performers and their coaches. After all, not only are they the people who are most interested in finding ways to improve performance, but they're also the ones from whom I have learned the most in my research. And indeed, I believe that there is much that expert performers and aspiring expert performers can do to improve their training. For instance, it has always been surprising to me when I talk to full-time athletes and their coaches how many of them have never taken the time to identify those aspects of performance that they would like to improve and then design training methods aimed specifically at those things. In reality, much of the training that athletes do, especially athletes in team sports, is carried out in groups with no attempt to figure out what each individual should be focusing on. Furthermore, very little has been done to learn about the mental representations that successful athletes use. The ideal approach to fixing this would be to have athletes verbally report their thinking while they are performing, which would make it possible for researchers, coaches, or perhaps even the athletes themselves to design training tasks to improve their representations of game situations, in the same way that we described in Chapter 3. There are, of course, some elite athletes who develop effective representations by themselves. But most of these top players are not even aware of how their thinking differs from those less accomplished, and the converse is certainly often true as well. That the less accomplished athletes don't understand how much weaker their mental representations are than those of the best in their sport. For example, over the past few years, I've spoken with coaches in a variety of sports, including Chip Kelly, head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles of the National Football League. These coaches are generally eager to learn how deliberate practice can improve the performance of their athletes. In a group meeting I had with all of the Eagles coaches in the spring of 2014, we discussed how all the great players seemed to be aware of what the relevant team and opposing players were doing so that they could discuss it after a training session or a game. However, I found that even those coaches who recognized the importance of effective mental representations did little to help the less elite players improve their representations. Instead, they generally found it easier to pick players who had already acquired effective mental representations and then provide them with additional training to further improve those representations. During a visit to the Manchester City Football Club in England in 2011, before that team won the Football Association Challenge Cup, I discussed similar issues. The coaches there were more receptive to talking about how to train representations because they trained young players, several of whom would eventually be allowed to play on an adult team during regular matches. I've also been working with Rod Haverluck, a swimming coach and president of the International Society of Swimming Coaching, to use insights from deliberate practice to improve swimming instruction. Rod and I have found that there is hardly any individualized coaching of or deliberate practice by swimmers at the lower and middle levels. Given how little work has been done to apply the principles of deliberate practice to the development of expert performers, particularly athletes, it is clear that there is great potential for improvement by focusing on individualized training and the assessment of the athlete's mental representations. And I will continue to work with coaches, trainers, and athletes to help them use deliberate practice more effectively. But the greatest potential benefits from deliberate practice, I believe, lie elsewhere. After all, the top performers in various highly specialized and highly competitive fields, the professional athletes, the world-class musicians, the chess grandmasters, and so on, make up just a tiny fraction of the world's population. And while it is a very visible and entertaining fraction, it will make a relatively small difference to the rest of the world if these few people get marginally better at what they do. There are other areas where many more people can be helped and where the improvements can be much larger because the training in those areas is even further away from what deliberate practice tells us is the ideal. Education is one of those areas. Education touches everyone, and there are a number of ways that deliberate practice could revolutionize how people learn. The first is pedagogical. How do students learn best? Deliberate practice has a great deal to say about that question. Let's take a closer look at that UBC physics class to see how the principles of deliberate practice can be applied to help students learn faster and better than they do with traditional approaches. The first thing that Wyman and his colleagues did in designing the class was to speak with the traditional instructors to determine exactly what the students should be able to do once they finished the section. As we discussed in Chapter 5, a major difference between the deliberate practice approach and the traditional approach to learning lies with the emphasis placed on skills versus knowledge, what you can do versus what you know. Deliberate practice is all about the skills. You pick up the necessary knowledge in order to develop the skills. Knowledge should never be an end in itself. Nevertheless, deliberate practice results in students picking up quite a lot of knowledge along the way. If you teach a student facts, concepts, and rules, those things go into long-term memory as individual pieces. And if a student then wishes to do something with them, use them to solve a problem, reason with them to answer a question, or organize and analyze them to come up with a theme or a hypothesis, the limitations of attention and short-term memory kick in. The student must keep all of these different, unconnected pieces in mind while working with them toward a solution. However, if this information is assimilated as part of building mental representations aimed at doing something, the individual pieces become part of an interconnected pattern that provides context and meaning to the information, making it easier to work with. As we saw in Chapter 3, you don't build mental representations by thinking about something, you build them by trying to do something, failing, revising, and trying again, over and over. When you're done, not only have you developed an effective mental representation for the skill you were developing, but you have also absorbed a great deal of information connected with that skill. When preparing a lesson plan, determining what a student should be able to do is far more effective than determining what that student should know. It then turns out that the knowledge part comes along for the ride. Once Wyman and his colleagues had put together a list of what things their students should be able to do, they transformed it into a collection of specific learning objectives. Again, this is a classic deliberate practice approach. When teaching a skill, break the lesson into a series of steps that the student can master one at a time, building from one to the next to reach the ultimate objective. While this sounds very similar to the scaffolding approach used in traditional education, it differs crucially in its focus on understanding the necessary mental representations at each step of the way and making sure that the student has developed the appropriate representations before moving to the next step. This seems to have been, for example, the crucial ingredients in the success of the Jump Math program described in the last chapter. The program carefully delineates which representations are necessary for the development of a particular math skill, and then teaches in a way that builds those representations in the students. Generally speaking, in almost any area of education, the most useful learning objectives will be those that help students develop effective mental representations. In physics, for example, it is always possible to teach students how to solve particular equations and how to decide which equations should be applied in which situations. But that's not the most important part of what physicists know. Research comparing physics experts with physics students has found that while the students may sometimes be almost as good as the experts at solving quantitative problems, that is, problems involving numbers that can be solved by applying the right equation, the students are far behind the experts in their ability to solve qualitative problems, or problems that involve concepts but no numbers. Something like, why is it hot in summer and cold in the winter? Answering a question like that requires less a command of numbers than it does a clear understanding of the concepts that underlie particular events or processes. That is, good mental representations. Most people, with the exception of science teachers, cannot correctly explain what causes the changing seasons, even though it is taught in science classes as early as elementary school. An amusing video taken at a Harvard University commencement shows a string of recent graduates confidently explaining that the seasons result from the Earth being closer to the sun in summer and farther away in winter. This is completely wrong, of course, since when it is summer in the Northern Hemisphere, it is winter in the Southern Hemisphere. The real cause of the seasons is the tilt of the Earth on its axis, but the point here is not the ignorance of Harvard graduates, but rather that so little of science education gives students the basic mental representations they need to think clearly about physical phenomena, rather than teaching them simply to plug numbers into an equation. To help the physics students in their class develop such mental representations, Wyman and his co-workers developed sets of clicker questions and learning tasks that would help them reach the learning objectives the instructors had previously identified. The clicker questions and tasks were chosen to trigger discussions that would lead the students to grapple with and apply the concepts they were learning, and ultimately to use those concepts to answer the questions and solve the tasks. The questions and tasks were also designed to push the students outside their comfort zones, to ask them questions whose answers they'd have to struggle for, but not so far outside their comfort zones that they wouldn't know how to start answering them. Wyman and his colleagues pre-tested the clicker questions and learning tasks on a couple of student volunteers who were enrolled in the course. They gave these students the questions and the learning tasks, and then had them think aloud as they reasoned their way toward the answers. Based on what the researchers heard during the think aloud sessions, they modified the questions and tasks, with a specific emphasis on avoiding misunderstandings and questions that were too difficult for the students to deal with. Then they went through a second round of testing with another volunteer, sharpening the questions and learning tasks even more. Finally, the classes were structured so that the students would have the opportunity to deal with the various concepts over and over again. getting feedback that identified their mistakes and showed how to correct them. Some of the feedback came from fellow students in the discussion groups, and some from the instructors. But the important thing was that the students were getting immediate responses that told them when they were doing something wrong and how to fix it. The redesigned physics class at the University of British Columbia offers a roadmap for redesigning instruction according to deliberate practice principles. Begin by identifying what students should learn how to do. The objectives should be skills, not knowledge. In figuring out the particular ways students should learn a skill, examine how the experts do it. In particular, understand as much as possible about the mental representations that experts use, and teach the skill so as to help students develop similar mental representations. This will involve teaching the skill step by step, with each step designed to keep students out of their comfort zone, but not so far out that they cannot master that step. Then give plenty of repetition and feedback. The regular cycle of try, fail, get feedback, try again, and so on, is how the students will build their mental representations. At the University of British Columbia, the success of Wyman's deliberate, practice-based approach to teaching physics has led many other professors there to follow suit. According to an article in Science magazine, in the years after the experiment, deliberate practice methods were adopted in nearly 100 science and mathematics classes there, with a total enrollment of more than 30,000 students. Since math and science professors have traditionally been very resistant to changing their teaching methods, this says a great deal about the quality of Wyman's findings. Redesigning teaching methods using deliberate practice could dramatically increase how quickly and how well students learn, as the almost unbelievable improvements in Wyman's students indicate. But it will require not only a change in mindset among educators, but much more research into the minds of experts. We're only just starting to understand the types of mental representations that experts use, and how to develop these representations with deliberate practice. There is much more to do. In addition to more effective teaching methods, there are other, less obvious ways that deliberate practice can be applied to education. In particular, I think there would be tremendous value in helping children, and especially adolescents, develop detailed mental representations in at least one area, for reasons that we will discuss below. This is not a goal of the current educational system, and generally the only students who do develop such representations are those who are pursuing some skill outside of school, playing a sport or a musical instrument, for instance. And even then, the students do not really understand what they're doing or recognize that their representations are part of a larger phenomenon that stretches across fields. One benefit that a young student, or anyone really, gets from developing mental representations is the freedom to begin exploring that skill on his or her own. In music, having clear representations of what musical pieces sound like, how the different sections of a piece fit together to create the whole, and how variations in one's playing can affect the sound, allows student musicians to play music for themselves or for others, and to improvise and explore on their own instruments. They no longer need a teacher to lead them down every path. They can head down some paths on their own. Something similar is true for academic subjects. Students who develop mental representations can go on to generate their own scientific experiments or to write their own books. And research has shown that many successful scientists and authors started their careers at a young age in just this way. The best way to help students develop their skills and mental representations in an area is to give them models they can replicate and learn from, just as Benjamin Franklin did when he improved his writing by reproducing articles from The Spectator. They need to try and fail, but with ready access to models that show what success looks like. Having students create mental representations in one area helps them understand exactly what it takes to be successful not only in that area but in others as well. Most people, even adults, have never attained a level of performance in any field that is sufficient to show them the true power of mental representations to plan, execute, and evaluate their performance in the way that expert performers do. And thus they never really understand what it takes to reach this level. Not just the time it takes, but the high-quality practice. Once they do understand what is necessary to get there in one area, they understand, at least in principle, what it takes in other areas. That is why experts in one field can often appreciate those in other fields. A research physicist may better understand what it takes to become a skilled violinist, if only in general terms, and a ballerina may better understand the sacrifice it takes to become a skilled painter. Our schools should give all students such an experience in some domain. Only then will they understand what is possible, and also what it takes to make it happen. Homo exercens. In the introduction to this book, I spoke of how deliberate practice can revolutionize our thinking about human potential. I do not see this as an exaggeration or overstatement. That revolution starts when we realize that the best among us in various areas do not occupy that perch because they were born with some innate talent, but rather because they have developed their abilities through years of practice, taking advantage of the adaptability of the human body and brain. But that realization is not enough. We need to give people the tools they need to harness that adaptability and take control of their own potential. Spreading the word about deliberate practice, as I am doing with this book, is part of that. But many of the necessary tools are still undeveloped. In most fields, we still don't know exactly what distinguishes experts from everyone else. Nor do we have many details about the experts' mental representations. We need to map out the various factors that make up an expert over his or her entire lifespan in order to provide direction for other people who want to develop expertise. Even before we have a comprehensive roadmap, however, we can get a good start down that road. As I mentioned above, we can help students develop expertise and effective mental representations in at least one area so that they can learn about expertise itself, what produces it, and how accessible it is to everyone. And, as we discussed in Chapter 6, developing a skill through deliberate practice can increase the motivation for further improvement because of the positive feedback one gets from possessing that skill. If we can show students that they have the power to develop a skill of their choice, and that while it is not easy, it has many rewards that will make it worthwhile, we make it much more likely that they will use deliberate practice to develop various skills over their lifetimes. Over time, then, by learning more about what goes into expert performance in various fields, and by creating a generation of students primed to take advantage of that, we could produce a new world, one in which most people understand deliberate practice and use it to enrich their lives and their children's. What kind of world would that be? To begin with, it would contain far more experts in far more fields than we have today. The societal implications of this would be enormous. Imagine a world in which doctors, teachers, engineers, pilots, computer programmers, and many other professionals honed their skills in the same way that violinists, chess players, and ballerinas do now. Imagine a world in which 50% of the people in these professions learn to perform at the level that only the top 5% manage today. What would that mean for our healthcare, our educational system, our technology? The personal benefits could be tremendous as well. I have spoken very little of this here, but expert performers get great satisfaction and pleasure from exercising their abilities, and they feel a tremendous sense of personal accomplishment from pushing themselves to develop new skills, particularly skills that are on the very edges of their fields. It is as if they are on a constantly stimulating journey, where boredom is never a problem because there are always new challenges and opportunities. And those experts whose skills relate to some sort of performance, the musicians, dancers, gymnasts, and so forth, report getting great pleasure from performing in public. When everything goes well, they experience a level of effortlessness similar in many ways to the psychological state of flow popularized by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. This gives them a precious high that few people other than experts ever experience. One of the most exciting times in my life was when I worked with Herb Simon and he received the Nobel Prize. Everyone in our group had this sense of being at the frontier of our area of science and feeling really lucky to be there. I imagine it must have been the same sort of excitement that the Impressionists felt as they were working to revolutionize art. Even those who don't reach the frontiers of a field can still enjoy the challenge of taking control of their own lives and improving their abilities. A world in which deliberate practice is a normal part of life would be one in which people had more volition and satisfaction. And I would argue that we humans are most human when we're improving ourselves. We, unlike any other animal, can consciously change ourselves to improve ourselves in ways we choose. This distinguishes us from every other species alive today, and as far as we know, from every other species that has ever lived. The classic conception of human nature is captured in the name we gave ourselves as a species, Homo sapiens. Our distant ancestors included Homo erectus, or upright man, because the species could walk upright, and Homo habilis, the handyman, so named because the species was at one time thought to be the earliest humans to have made and used stone tools. We call ourselves knowing man because we see ourselves as distinguished from our ancestors by our vast amount of knowledge. But perhaps a better way to see ourselves would be as Homo exercens, or practicing man, the species that takes control of its life through practice and makes of itself what it will. It is quite possible that this new understanding couldn't have come at a better time. Thanks to technology, our world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. 200 years ago, a person could learn a craft or a trade and be fairly certain that that education would suffice for a lifetime. People born in my generation grew up thinking the same way. Get an education, get a job, and you'll be set until you retire. That has changed in my lifetime. Many jobs that existed 40 years ago have disappeared, or else have changed so much as to be almost unrecognizable. And people coming into the workforce today should expect to change careers 2 or 3 times during their working lives. As for the children being born today, no one knows. But I think it's safe to say that the changes won't be slowing down. How do we as a society prepare for that? In the future, most people will have no choice but to continuously learn new skills, so it will be essential to train students and adults about how to learn efficiently. With the technological revolution, there are new opportunities to make teaching more effective. It is possible, for example, to videotape real-world experiences of doctors, athletes, and teachers, and create libraries and learning centers where students could be trained in such a way that avoids having to learn on the job and risk the welfare of patients, students, and clients. We need to start now. For adults who are already in the work world, we need to develop better training techniques based on the principles of deliberate practice and aimed at creating more effective mental representations that not only will help them improve the skills they use in their current jobs, but that will enable them to develop new skills for new jobs. And we need to get the message out. You can take charge of your own potential. But it is the coming generations who have the most to gain. The most important gifts we can give our children are the confidence in their ability to remake themselves again and again, and the tools with which to do that job. They will need to see firsthand, through their own experiences of developing abilities they thought were beyond them, that they control their abilities and are not held hostage by some antiquated idea of natural talent. And they will need to be given the knowledge and support to improve themselves in whatever ways they choose. Ultimately, it may be that the only answer to a world in which rapidly improving technologies are constantly changing the conditions under which we work, play, and live will be to create a society of people who recognize that they can control their development and understand how to do it. This new world of Homo exercens may well be the ultimate result of what we have learned and will learn about deliberate practice and about the power it gives us to take our future into our own hands. This has been an Audible Studios production of Peak, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise, written by Anders Ericsson and Robert Poole, performed by Sean Rennett. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2016 K. Anders Ericsson.